In today's episode,
what you do is you end up connecting kind of things that are happening in the moment and saying, okay, there's all this density. Social media was like making the world very loud. All these things were making the world very loud. I thought, okay, there's got to be this thing around quiet. Because whenever there's a trend, there's always kind of a counter trend that follows. And so I was like, oh, it's interesting to be like an antisocial thing. And that's really important to be able to go out and get physical space. Physical space is very important. So anyway, kind of putting all these things together. At the time, I'd written 3 books. They had been successful. Like, I could have continued and had this writing career forever if I wanted. And instead, I took a shot and I started this.
This is Bilal Zaidi, and you're listening to Creator Lab, where I learn how to turn ideas into action. I'll bring you conversations with leading entrepreneurs, nonprofit founders, award-winning designers, educators, artists, and everything else in between. We dig deep into their stories, have honest conversations about how they made their ideas come to life, and the lessons learned along the way. This episode is sponsored by InstaSleep Mint Melts, the drug-free, convenient sleep aid that melts in your mouth. They were invented by the physician called Dr. Lee during his medical residency, where he saw the need for an effective sleep aid that didn't contain harmful chemicals, cause addiction, or leave him feeling groggy in the morning. I've used them myself for long flights and for sorting out my sleeping pattern after a trip. They taste like mints and are really convenient since they melt in your mouth. InstaSleep Mint Melts are now available at Target, Amazon, or directly on their site at instasleep.co. Hey, Julian, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So for anyone who hasn't heard of you and Breather, like my mum, she's listening. She's my number one fan. Yeah. So hi, mum. Who are you, man? And what are you working on nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, I have a long history, but right now I'm the co-founder and the CEO of a company called Breather, which is a venture-backed startup to raise something like $80 million that is basically an on-demand room startup or an on-demand kind of meeting room startup. Before that, I was a New York Times bestselling author. I did a whole bunch of things.
We're going to go into detail about how you thought of Breather and, and that sort of stuff in a minute, but before we do that, one of the things that I wanted to focus on today was about detecting patterns, because I think that's one thing that is consistent within all of your different work. So whether that was writing about social media in the early days or starting a company that is now quite innovative and doing something new and doing something first, as I've heard you talked about. So is that kind of the underlying principle of what you think you're best at?
You know, there's that Scott Adams or the Dilbert the guy who wrote the comics, draws the comics, would say that you only actually need to be good at like a few things in order to become very good at a combination of those things. And so he's okay at drawing and he's okay at making office jokes, but that makes him the best in the world at this shitty comic that people love, right? And so in my world, in a world of technology, one of the most important things is timing. And so one of the good fortunes that I've had throughout my career, which I started actually in podcasting like almost a decade and a half ago, was that I was very good at finding the right time to start something. And that's what I think patterns really fundamentally are, is just noticing kind of subtle like nuances in the environment and changes macroeconomically or inside of culture and seeing an effect and saying, now is the right time to start this because of this thing that I just noticed or these few things. And so I've, by accident, really not knowing that this was like the thing that I did on purpose, I've done that like over and over and over again. And I would say that likely if there's a reason for me having done anything right, it's probably because of that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we're going to come back to how you thought about that in more detail in a bit. And just in terms of scale, just so people can understand, you mentioned 70, 80 million in venture funding.
Yeah.
Is that Series C?
It was a $40 million Series C led by Menlo Ventures.
Are you able to share revenue or employee numbers?
I mean, we have 160 employees. We have a hockey stick curve of growth. Like, it's impressive.
Up and to the right.
Yeah, up and to the right, but like a lot. And and it, you know, I mean, it appears that we're doing things in the right way and really focusing. We believe we have a very large company ahead of us and a lot of, you know, it's also a lot of work as you're doing that. But it started very small, like going back to kind of this principle of like how these things get to where they are. In this case, I was noticing that in an increasingly kind of, like, we're in Manhattan right now, we're on Worcester Street in Soho, and in one of our breather units, actually. And so what I would notice is that we'd be in increasingly dense environments. Mm. I have hearing problems. I can't hear properly. I haven't heard probably for years. And I would be noticing that it's like, man, it's like super, cities are super dense. They're getting denser. People are moving into cities. 50% of the population of the world live in cities for the first time. But like the actual infrastructure of cities is not changing. Mm. And so I was like, oh, it's interesting. Like, I really wish at the time I was a freelancer because I was writing these books. And when you write books and they sell well, people fly you places, right? Yeah. And they'll take you to do talks and so on. So I'd be in city after city, basically either in my house if I was at home or in hotel rooms if I was somewhere else. And then I'd go to Starbucks, basically. Like, and so my life was my house or Starbucks with no office.
Yeah.
And as I was thinking about it, man, I should really go to another place, not even really thinking about it much as an office space at all. I realized I should just have it wherever I want it. Mm. Versus having it in one place and going to one place. I didn't have the experience, I know you were at Google.
Yeah.
Of going to the same place every day for like a decade. Like, I've never done that. And so I reinvented this, well, reinvented. I suspected that people would like having a network of places that is spread out.
Yeah.
And so, and there's close to 150 units in Manhattan today, for example.
Crazy. When you first started Breather, how many units did you start off with?
It was super puny. It was like three. What we had to do is we had to connect locks to, you see that the locks are on the door here. You had to connect locks to mobile phones.
Yeah.
And so there's this idea that remotely you could connect to any door, right? Which is a super powerful idea. Right around that time, Kickstarter, all these kind of electronic locks were coming out on Kickstarter around 2013 or something. And I was like, wow, like you can open a door with your phone. I was like, this is so amazing. And so I thought, well, okay, that's interesting for your own house, but I mean, it could be very interesting if you could open multiple doors with your phone, like lots of them. I'd be like, wow, that people would really use that, you know? And so what you do is you end up connecting kind of things that are happening in the moment and saying, okay, there's all this density. Social media was like making the world very loud. All these things were making the world very loud. I thought, okay, there's gotta be this thing around quiet. Because whenever there's a trend, there's always kind of a counter trend that follows.
Yeah.
Right? And so I was like, oh, it's interesting to be like an antisocial thing. And that's really important to be able to go out and get physical space. Physical space is very important. So anyway, kind of putting all these things together. At the time, I'd written three books. They had been successful. Like, I could have continued and had this writing career forever if I wanted. And instead, I took a shot and I started this.
And so who's your customer base right now?
It's a lot of corporations, a huge number of corporations, but also freelancers going from like a space here would be like, could be used by a therapist and their client, for example, right?
It's a beautiful space, by the way.
Yeah, it's lovely. It was sponsored by WorkOf, which is a furniture company. So all this furniture was given to us. It's super lovely. So like anyone who is essentially attempting to expand or contract their office without having like a giant commitment, right?
Okay.
So even if you go to a co-working space, you have a 30-day, 60-day commitment or something. Whereas for us, it's like, you know, we book the space for 8:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
We'll be gone by 11 at latest, and then it's gone. And we never have to think about it again. Someone else is going to be booking it after that.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of idea of sharing high quality space, but not like sharing it by being next to each other, but rather sharing it in the sense of time.
Yeah.
That one person after another is using it as their own.
Mm. How big is this market? When you guys look at the long-term vision of the company, how do you think about working out how big it can be?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's very obvious. People even use it inside their buildings where they already have office space, right?
That's crazy.
Because it's just an extra meeting room for them. So if you extrapolate into that, it really could be in every building that exists in the commercial real estate industry. We have one in our office. We used to have one in our old office in New York. We had two, and we'd use them at extra rooms. And we have one in near our office in Montreal in our building, and it's used by the building. And when it's not used by the building, it's used by outside people for meeting rooms, right?
Yeah.
For somewhere that people coming into the building. So you have this great combo of like taking space that is normally locked down and really like making it permeable and making it accessible to all people, and almost like securely giving people access to a space they would never see otherwise, which I think is a super interesting and powerful idea.
Yeah. And I don't want to go too much into it, but just one thing that sprung up when you talked about the remote locking. Mm-hmm. So as I came into Breather for the first time today, and mm-hmm. I've got the app, and it tells me mm-hmm. type in this code. We're at an age where a lot of people are talking about cybersecurity at a macro government level, and all the leaks that have come out in the last few years. Mm-hmm. How do you guys think about security so that someone can't just intercept that?
Yeah, that's that right. Message? Well, actually, these locks are not connected to the internet. So because they're not connected to the internet, they cannot be hacked in that way, right? So even when you go and unlock this door, it doesn't connect to the internet like at all.
Okay.
So a space, that's the best way to prevent something from being hacked, is not connected to the internet at all. So it does have a fairly sophisticated technology behind it, but that technology does not involve having to connect to the internet all the time. So anyway, you can look it up. It's you know, there's lots of different ways to do this, but definitely, like, in terms of locks, I know lots of people that are working on lock problems. There's a company actually down the street that has been spending a lot of money, great designers working on a lock, and they had to, in order to make it work, definitely like minimize the connection to the internet. Because, you know, as soon as you're connected to the internet all of the time, the security that you have is probably worse than the security of the guys that are trying to get into it.
Yeah.
So it's something, those are things that come as a consequence of having to innovate or come up with a new idea, is like all this other stuff that comes with it as you grow.
Yeah. We'll come back to Breather in a minute, but before we do that, I'd love to just go back, take it all the way back to kind of you growing up. I always like to hear about, you're making a face for people that can't see us.
I don't even know what I'm going to say.
Great. That was a plan. when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? You know, that age old question.
That's a good question. I think I wanted to be a psychologist or something. I didn't really have a career. My father was a career counselor. He would work with executives that wanted to change jobs or whatever. And so he had been trained by, like, you know, the people that had written like all of the career counseling books at the time. It was a very famous book called like What Color Is Your Parachute? And that book was like, basically it was like, how do you want your life to go? Or like, what kind of person are you? And that's kind of the theme of that book. And so I had the freedom. My parents gave me the freedom to be whatever the hell I wanted. Mm. They didn't pressure me to do anything. I imagine they might have been worried at some point because I really did not figure things out. The podcast was really when I started, like when things started working for me. It was like right around. And
how old were you at that
point? 24.
24. So that's still, you know, a few years into, it's not like you were 16 at high school.
No, not at all. Yeah. I'd done like other things before then, but not like big things. And that's when I went from working in a call center, which I had worked in for like many years.
Yeah.
To doing a podcast full time due to a complete coincidence. But my parents always taught me that I could do whatever I wanted to do and never pressured me to become a certain type of person.
That's important.
Yeah, it is actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I know a lot of people that ended up in careers they really just weren't suited to. And and it's really crazy how many, especially doing this sort of podcast where you meet really, you know, people that are successful in their own fields. Mm-hmm. What I liked, what you said earlier, was about focusing on what you're good at, and like there are 100 things you're not good at, but working out what you're good at is pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, other people are, it's funny, we're doing these 360 feedbacks in my company right now, which are basically a type of feedback where anonymously you will ask your peers what they think of you and how well you're doing at things. And so it's just really, because you don't often like go to your friends and you say, hey, what am I good at? I did this one by text, you should try this.
Yeah.
I went to 5 of my friends, I forget where this exercise came from, but I went to 5 of my friends and I said, hey, what are the 5 things that you think that I'm good at or whatever? Yeah. And they would just respond super candidly. People that know me for 20 years, they would never tell me this otherwise, right?
Because it was anonymous. So there was...
No. In this case, this is a separate exercise.
So, okay.
So me texting my friends, try this exact exercise and ask them, like, what are the things that you think I'm good at? They'll just tell you and you'll be like, wow. And then, so inevitably they will say, okay, now do me. So then you'll tell them, and it's this really like positive exercise where you're like, here's what I like about you, which you don't normally say to your friends.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But in this exercise, it's what they call a 360 review. So anonymously your peers, in my case, everyone reports up into me, obviously. Mm. Right. So it's important for anonymity in case people want to say that I am bad at something and that embarrasses them or whatever.
Yeah.
So you learn all these amazing things about yourself, that it's true what you're saying. You don't really figure out what you're good at until you've been doing it a while.
Mm. Well, when you're actually open to the feedback as well.
I think you have to be open to
especially
it.
The negative or constructive feedback,
as that's right.
we like to call it.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind me asking, in that 360 process that you've had from your mm-hmm. employees,
yeah.
what were the few good things that they said yeah. and some of the constructive things that you are working on?
What happened is we went from about 10 people like a few years ago to 160 people today. We'd be at 300 people at the end of the year, right?
That's crazy.
So in that time, the reason I'm telling you this is because one of the key things is that I discovered I need to spend more time with each person. And it's not in my nature to be like super gregarious and like, yeah, let's all go out for drinks later. And so I learned that I definitely needed to do more of that. Mm. Other than that, that was the key thing. Other things was just like every founder is learning to be a CEO as they're doing it. Mm. So they know some of the things that they have to do. I read a lot. So I'm constantly trying to learn from other founders that have done better than I have. How I should prevent errors or do the best that I can. That's definitely one thing that, and the thing is with all this feedback is people tell you a thing you already know anyway, but that
it solidifies the thought.
Yeah, it solidifies the thought, but it was nothing is ever a surprise in these things.
Yeah. Well, I think you're pretty introspective, but I think some people are sometimes in their own worlds. Mm. And so I think for those people, yeah, it might be more valuable. But I think it's valuable for everyone to go through that process.
Yeah.
Sometimes. I think that for me, when I've asked for feedback, the thing that's helped me the most is just saying it's not personal, though I guess inherently it is. But mm-hmm. meaning it's they're saying it, their intention is good.
Yeah.
They're trying to help me.
That's right.
And I think if you focus on that, it's easier to digest. Mm-hmm. I think to say it's not personal is probably not correct either, though, because it is by definition personal.
Yeah.
Anyway, you've talked about detecting patterns and you definitely are very good at that. What makes you so good at that?
I'm just fascinated by this idea of how the world actually works. Mm. Like my point of view is that there's this grand, whatever, like mathematical scheme that's playing out or something that occurs in every person and every object at the same time. And people are unconsciously like, they're just playing like the same CD or the same song, like over and over again in their head or something. So there's a great deal of kind of undiscovered things underneath. Maybe this is like, I was telling you I wanted to be a psychologist, but maybe I'm very interested by people and how they work and how systems work. This company, this thing that I designed, I guess, from a perspective of the system, is a system I had to figure out and say, okay, how is this going to work? There's going to be bookings and then people are going to show up. How are they going to open the door? Like, I need to figure those things out. Most of the time, those systems are not discovered. They're just underneath the surface. And I find it very interesting to try and learn what those are. And also they tend to give you like an advantage, I don't mean over people, I mean an advantage over like how the world works. Because the world is playing out like this grand opera, right? And so you should have a sense of like what is going on and how to prepare and all these things. I just started surfing recently, which is why I'm wearing a surf hat. So I just came back from my friend's place. Me and my girlfriend went there in Santa Cruz, and he's an entrepreneur as well. He runs a venture-backed company also.
What's that called, the company?
The name of the company is vidIQ.
Okay.
The celebrities and lots of other people use it to understand where their YouTube views are coming from and how to get more of them and how to optimize their audience.
Cool.
And yeah, it's a cool company. And so you get this, when you're learning to surf, it's actually all about timing and sensing things as they're about to happen, right? Because you have to read waves and you have to have all these skills in order to be able to do it properly. Someone else was telling me this, you have waves coming basically all the time in technology. Mm. And sometimes there's like, maybe there's five surfers like ready to catch it. And they're all good surfers and they all have the same skill, but one person is exactly in the right spot. And so because they just happen to be in the right spot for that particular wave, they take off on that wave and four other people are left behind. And that's just the way the things are. So I'm really fascinated by this idea of seeing things ahead of time and having a sense of, like my, for example, my company's pretty successful.
Yeah.
So I'm always thinking like, why? You know, it just seems like an obvious thing. But when you start a company and it's just growing, sometimes you understand some of the reasons it's successful, but there's others you might not understand. And when you see another in a competitor or something, or you see two books that were published at the same time, one wrote about the same thing, but different timing or different authors or something. Why did this one work and this one not work? So I'm very interested by all of those things.
You talked about timing, and there's a couple of things on that. One is, I feel like it kind of brings up the conversation around luck versus skill. And this is a pretty philosophical conversation. But how much of you detecting patterns is about the skill of it, which, you know, you talked about being curious and making sure you're looking out for certain macro trends, versus is there an element of luck as well?
Yeah, there undoubtedly is.
And what if you were putting a percentage for both, like proportionately, how much of it is skill to you versus luck?
Well, you're going to catch, it's really about the waves that are going to hit you. Like if you're just like, I've got to hit this one thing. This is kind of the challenge with, like, people that start companies. You know, you have these in Silicon Valley, you have these, and in New York and in Montreal, really everywhere, you have these kind of serial entrepreneurs that are just like, they're just going to throw themselves at something and they just don't care because they want to run a company. Mm. I was never like that. I didn't want to start a company.
Yeah.
I knew it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
And at the time I had a pretty sweet life because I was just writing a book a year, getting paid like a pretty meaningful advance and getting paid like 10K or whatever, a speaking engagement. Mm. So it was really like not bad as a life.
Yeah.
But when you have these people that are just kind of deliberately trying to catch one thing, that's super challenging because it's really not up to you which one you're going to succeed at, right? Like, you just have to keep going at it and going at it. And so, yes, there's an enormous element of luck. You might never catch one. Mm. You might never catch anything. But there's this idea of like every time you're like, oh, that's interesting, let's just put this thing out there and see what happens.
Yeah.
And that's how my podcast ended up on Sirius Satellite Radio, which we were talking about before the show, is not because my podcast was that good. You know, I'm sure it was all right. It's just because there weren't a lot of them. So,
well, I think you also can, to a certain extent, you make your own luck, you know. I think luck is quite probably not the best word to use because people have this negative, some people have a negative connotation to that. Like, I work so hard, why are you saying I'm lucky sort of vibe? But I think the better way of describing maybe is just saying increasing your chances of probability. Like,
that's
if
right.
me and you played poker right now and you're really good at poker, there's a bunch of stuff out of both of our control, right? Like, we both don't know what cards are going to show up,
that's right.
what hands we get. But if you're better at poker than me, you're going to beat me most of the time.
Yes.
And you probably would because I'm not good at poker. but I think when I use the word luck, actually me and my brother talk about this quite a lot, and he almost says to me like, well, I don't think there's a thing called luck. And, you know, he gets very philosophical about the word luck. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's the right word. But I think thinking about things that are out of your control, that's how I'm describing it.
Yeah.
So if, for example, there's something that a drastic, terrible thing that happens out of both of our controls tomorrow, that potentially impacts the economy, and the economy then filters down to our companies, et cetera. So that is what I mean by, you know, riding a wave could also mean we've had 8 years of really good growth. The stock market's at, it's close to the top of the market. It's been, real estate's doing really well, et cetera. So just those sort of things, that's what I'm talking about when I talk about luck for people listening.
Mm-hmm. They're all the same. Like, so you inevitably are going to have good timing or bad timing or good luck or bad luck.
Yeah. But you can increase your chances.
Yeah, handle whatever you have under your control.
Yeah. So talking about detecting patterns, do you think this is a learned behavior? Is this something that people listening can become better at?
So, okay, you have this dude, Charlie Munger. Have you ever heard this name?
Yeah, of course.
So Charlie Munger is he the co-founder? No, he's just a business partner of Warren Buffett in Berkshire Hathaway, right? So Warren Buffett is famously the
best investor
of all time. Yeah. And he always says, Charlie is smarter than me and all these things. So I was talking and listening to an entrepreneur recently, maybe it was Ben Horowitz, I don't know, someone. And they were saying there were three books that really mattered. One of them happened to be the Charlie Munger book that I happen to have on my bookcase and is half completed, and it's called Poor Charlie's Almanac. And so it's this book you literally cannot buy except from one, from the like the Charlie Munger like society or something. And it's 300 pages and it's massive. It's like the size of this table, it feels like. But it's, you can't buy it on Amazon. Like you can't buy it anywhere except in this one place. So then you order this book and it's basically like it teaches you his philosophy of thinking. His philosophy of thinking is learn all of the systems in the world, biological systems, economic systems, business systems, electronic systems, programming systems, all these things. And there's all these give you this these frameworks for how things work. You're going to encounter, by the way, this is clearly not my idea, but this is someone else's idea. I'm just repeating it.
Yeah.
Take all these frameworks, and then what's going to happen is you're going to encounter this new idea. And when you encounter this new idea, you're going to have this, what he called a lattice of frameworks, lattices of frameworks, different frameworks that are on top of each other. And that, like, imagine, like, you drop a ball on this kind of framework, it could easily fall through. But you have 20 different frameworks on top of each other. I'm doing a thing right now in front of him.
With the hands.
With my hands. You drop the ball, all these different frameworks, something's going to catch it.
Yeah.
So what happens is it just comes from enormous amounts. It's not about education at all. I don't have a college degree. I don't think I need one. Clearly lots of other successful people don't need one.
Yeah.
But what you do need is enormous access to information that is going to help you understand previous situations and they're to help you understand how things work in another domain. How does you have a preamp in front of you or what is it's just a preamp?
It's a, I don't know if it's technically a preamp. It's a portable recorder called a Zoom H6.
Yeah.
Someone can tell me if that's a preamp or not.
So because it has two audio ins like this, that it might be a preamp. So so if that's the case, this works in a certain way. And you might know how it works. I happen to not know how it, well, the inside, the electronics, I don't know how it works. And but if I did, I would be able to apply that elsewhere, not just in electronic circumstances, but in other places. And so when Charlie Munger talks about this, he says, when you have all of these different frameworks, okay, how does cash flow work? How does cells regenerate? Like, how is it that my eyes are seeing color? Like all these different things that are completely not really related to each other. But then you'll take it and you'll look at this new circumstance and you'll be like, oh, I see. This is like when this other thing happens in this other world. And anyway, his point of view is that this is the best way of understanding the world and seeing things with a certain sophistication that other people lack. I'm not saying I have it either, but maybe that I have a portion of it. And you get it by really widely reading. I spent a long time before I ran a company reading a book a week. And it's one of my blog posts that I wrote that's pretty famous. And I would read 52 books a year at least. And I would just constantly be like absorbing information, even if a shit ton of it was bad.
Yeah.
It didn't matter because eventually I was going to encounter something smart.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so I just kept going and going and going and going. And it's a very valuable habit to develop, just access to tons of stuff.
Yeah. So I think it actually goes to kind of what I've been trying to do with this podcast is trying to bring people from different worlds. That was one of the things I found when I was so used to hanging out with tech startup people, right? You encounter the same concepts over and over again, and they're really valuable concepts. But then when you speak to a Scott Harrison from Charity Water or Aaron Zuckers from Sundara, they're working in a completely different world. Or Nico Perez from Mixcloud, who has never raised VC money, right? So you start to see these similarities and differences and nuances that I think are sometimes hard to see when you're just focused in one small area.
Yeah.
And I think growing up, our education system has always been about eventually specializing.
Yes.
Because it came from this factory mindset. And that hasn't necessarily evolved. You know, you could argue that either way, but I think what I'm seeing more and more of is this concept of the expert generalist.
Yeah.
People always say to me, like, you know, that old phrase about being a jack of all trades. I almost felt like that was that was always told to me as a negative thing.
Yes.
They were like, don't be a jack of all trades, be a master of one or whatever the phrase is. And I get that, but I feel like we've moved way beyond that. And now you can be, I wouldn't say an expert in lots of things, but you can learn like 70% of
yeah.
the basis of it. Mm-hmm. And then it might take 20, 30 years to be the expert in it. But mm-hmm. to get the 70-80% of
yeah.
that knowledge base, mm-hmm. and that's what I've been trying to do, you know, for the last 5-10 years, is that that's how my kind of learning has been focused. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned a lot of books, specifically mm-hmm. for people that are listening. What other sources of knowledge are you looking at to try to understand where things are going? Are there certain blogs you read, people you follow, newsletters, podcasts, mm-hmm. obviously books? People should read your post about reading a book a week. Mm-hmm. But if that isn't going to happen for that person,
yeah.
right?
Well, I mean, what's going to happen is the only other one, I think on it, genuinely the only other one that matters, because the books have access to all of the information in history ever. Okay, so by definition, the more access to that you have, presuming you're reading the right books, and all I mean by that is you're learning from them, not reading Archie comics or something.
Yeah.
Then you're going to progressively absorb information. You're going to do a lot more than most people, even most smart people, and that will be very valuable. But then the other one is conversation with people that you respect, and I think that those are the only two things that you need to do.
Yeah.
In terms of trying to understand the world better, I say that with a grain of salt, but I think that like those are the 80-20 kind of two things.
Yeah.
And the reason is because a conversation is like a book you can direct.
Yeah.
You can actually make it go in another way.
Yeah.
In the way that you want to. So if I go into, I had never run a company, okay,
yeah.
except like a company out of my own basement.
Yeah.
And I did not know how to raise money, and I did not know how to hire people. I didn't know anything. I cannot emphasize, like, people used to, now, people yeah. that met me then, that would talk to me, and I would ask about like entrepreneurialism and so on. Like, they would, now they make fun of me based on how far I've gotten,
yeah.
considering how ignorant I was at the time.
Yeah.
So it's true that I was ignorant. That's not an exaggeration. I really was. But the other thing is that I had no shame about asking people just stupid, stupid questions.
Yeah.
And just be like, okay, and then how does that work? And why does this? And
not being embarrassed to ask the stupid question.
Right? Just yeah. trying to get all of the info. What happens, I think, even happens to me, is people become shy about asking for things. Mm. And they're like, well, I'm going to look stupid if I ask this question, and I shouldn't do that. In actuality, you just ask a question, get the information, and just proceed like that. Like, especially if running a venture-backed company is it's a win or die scenario. Mm. My company is not there anymore, but because now we have a model and it works, right?
Yeah.
Like, so we're in a different world. We're not in a venture world, we're in a growth world. Mm. But most venture-backed companies are in a succeed or die scenario. Mm. And so under those circumstances, the consequences are so great for failure that you might as well just like eliminate all the shame and just be like, give me the information that I need. What's the next thing? How did you decide? You had product market fit? How'd you know you get that?
Yeah.
What did that feel like? Okay, then what happened? So when the stakes are high, well, you should get used to it when the stakes are not high, so that when the stakes are high, you can just do everything you need to do in order to get as yeah. far as you can.
Yeah. So I agree. That's kind of why I started this podcast, right? Because mm-hmm. I get to meet people like you and other people and ask mm-hmm. them all these detailed questions, mm-hmm. and it's super valuable for me personally. I would say for people, let's say you think you don't have time or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, you can listen to these podcasts and the other 10, right. 20 that I would definitely recommend, that, you know, people do amazing work. They're already having these conversations for you to listen to.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So that's great already. I don't think anything beats you doing it yourself, because you have to do all the research for it as well. But for people that are, you know, you mentioned you wrote these books and you got access to a bunch of, you know, interesting people. You mentioned Gary Vaynerchuk before, who ended up mm-hmm. investing, I think, seed round yes. for your company. Uh-huh. Avinash, who was also on this show, was on the speaking circuit with you. So you got mm-hmm. to meet a lot of really interesting people from that. If there's someone listening here who says, well, look, I'm in my job, I don't have those connections right
yeah.
now, what mm-hmm. can people do to really accelerate that process yeah. to meet good people?
Yeah, so everyone has to use the one advantage that they have, whatever that is. So in my case, my advantage was timing, as you mentioned also in this show, earlier, before the show maybe, is I kind of have a radio voice. In fact, I used to do radio commercials before I did yeah. a podcast. So maybe that was the way that I could use my advantage to get where I needed to go. And so, but everyone has it, and everyone else's advantage kind of landscape is mostly flat in the sense that they have no advantages or they have disadvantages in most circumstances. And so I want to emphasize that there are people like, you know, Evan Spiegel or whatever, who start out with buying Porsches and marrying supermodels and are billionaires by the age of 25. It's
found a Snapchat for people who don't know.
Right. But that is obviously the minority of cases. Mm. I just think you have to figure out what that advantage is, that core thing, and then look for the moment. This is a classic Steve Jobs story. They would be like, okay, so what are you going to do? Like you restarted, you became the CEO of your own company again. You saved it from bankruptcy by having a few successes. These new iMacs had just come out, maybe iBooks by that time. Someone asked him, it was obviously a very general story. I don't remember the anecdote that well. Someone said, what are you going to do now? How are you going to, you know, get to the next place? And he's just like, I'm going to wait for the next wave. And then I'm going to catch it, because that's all that I can do, is you wait for the right moment for something to happen. Mm. And so you kind of have to train yourself to do that, in the sense that you're going to encounter, the reason that I started this company that I started is because I examined it from a framework of the regret minimization framework. You ever heard of this before?
Yeah, I think I've come across it. But
so it's a Jeff Bezos said this a long time ago. He sort of had this four quadrant way of thinking about things. Okay, so the internet is going to be a thing. He had worked at a hedge fund at the time.
And this is the founder of Amazon.
The founder of Amazon, yeah. That's right. So he was like, he worked at a hedge fund at the time. They had told him, do this analysis on the internet. Like, not like Googling. Yeah. I mean, literally do an analysis about the internet.
The concept called the internet.
Of the concept of internet and what it was going to become. Mm. And so he does this analysis and he's like, wow, this is a pretty interesting thing. And he goes, I think there could be what we would call an everything store. Mm. And this is where this anecdote comes from, this book, The Everything Store.
Yeah.
And so he says, that would be insane. Holy crap. So in his world, he has two decisions, like a decision tree to make. Mm. Decision one, or not really, you know, options A and B, the internet becomes a thing and the internet does not become a thing. I don't know the answer. He didn't know the answer at the time. And then the other decisions that he can make are, I start this company or I don't start this company. Because he was like, wow, this could be very big.
Mm. Inevitably it was.
but he didn't know that at the time. Right? Yeah. So he thought about his own worldview and how he wanted to make that decision. And so he said, well, okay, if the internet does not become a thing and I start this company, I will regret it. That would be too bad, but then I'll come back and I'll work at another hedge fund. It'll be okay. If the internet does not become a thing and I don't start it, I'll be grateful. I'll just, I just saved myself like a couple of years of my life or something. Yeah. Now, if the internet does become a thing, and that this means that there will be this everything store, and I do start it, I'll be insanely successful, hopefully. But if the internet does become a thing and I don't do it, I will kill myself, because this would be the biggest opportunity that I will ever come across.
Yeah.
So I knew about this framework when I started this company. I thought, well, this is either nothing or it's a very, very, very big idea. Mm. And I could not think of something that was more valuable to do with my time at the time. Mm. It's like, this is very, very large. And it has proven to be meaningfully large. And so time will tell whether it is insanely large.
Yeah.
But I like my odds. So what you need at that time, right at that moment where that wave is coming at you, is you need to have trained yourself sufficiently to know that you're going to go. Mm. Because most people would be like, oh, that sounds like a pretty good idea. The most common thing that I heard at the time when I started this company was, wow, yeah, I thought about that once. Yeah. And I'd be like, I don't give a shit. Like, that sucks for you. Like, you know, too bad.
People say that.
Like, why didn't you do anything?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's awful. So it's really not about the information. The idea is out there. Every idea is out there.
Yeah. If it was about information, we'd all have six packs, right?
That's right. We would all have six packs, but we don't.
Yeah.
And so what you need is the training. What I mean is you need to have built the pattern. You need to have built the habit inside of yourself to make the right decision at the right time.
Yeah.
And it's not obvious to do that, because most people, because your brain is training you to just sit on the couch all day and just like reproduce and die.
Specifically for Breva, we kind of touched on it before, but what were some of those macro trends that you had identified that has now become Breva? Mm-hmm. And the second part to that is, if someone is looking ahead, are there certain macro trends outside of what you're working on that are valuable too?
It is so hard for me to say what things exist outside. Because what happens when you're growing a thing is you don't know this when you start a thing. You're like, well, I could probably have 5 people working on this. And then you have 150 people. And then you're like, I need more. Like, it just keeps. So the point is you have this focus that I have on my company. And so I cannot really say with any specificity. I know that I have caught a number of trends over time that have really helped propel me to a certain place. I'm very grateful for that. But in my world, the things that I would notice are universalities that I had seen before. So one of the things that I knew is space is universally valuable and rare and scarce. So especially in cities, but everywhere, land has value and space has value and is very useful for people. Like when you have a space, regardless of what it's for, that is, it makes your life better and you can do a thing with that space versus not having the space.
Yeah.
And I'd experienced that personally. So I knew that space, the idea that you could segment space and kind of pseudo like sell it or like chunk it, like that space would never degrade. It would never be a thing that's not valuable until we're all uploaded into the internet forever, right? Like when we're all become ghost in the shell superhumans, then space is not valuable. Until then, it is valuable. So you're working with a fundamental framework of value that is, and it's scarce. There's not an unlimited amount of it. It's not like cloud computing where you have infinite future capacity, right? And see, depending on the listener, we're talking about frameworks. We understand each other when we're talking around here. So like why is cloud computing different than real estate? So there's it's kind of like bases for how to talk around things that will get you to the next level or something, right? So that would be one, is this idea of limited, scarce, valuable things because we're human monkeys that need a place to sit down. And that there's a scarce amount of it. And capturing that amount and being able to subdivide it efficiently was highly valuable. Then there was this idea of density and how cities were becoming dense and louder, and they were becoming insanely hard to navigate in some spaces. One of my investors would say that cities have network effects. What they mean by cities having network effects is this idea that even when cities are bad, when they're hard to navigate, when there's congestion, where there's all these things, it doesn't matter because you can't leave them, like you're attached, right? And so the same way that Facebook has a network effect, that Twitter has a network effect, that Uber has a network effect.
What's a network effect for people that don't know what that is?
Yeah, so this is what I was gonna get into. A network effect is the idea that, like with a fax machine, when there's one fax, and that's the only person you know with a fax, that fax is useless. Now you have a second fax that your buddy has. A fax is a thing that you used to use in the 80s. So most people will understand that listen or will know what a fax is. Now you have one person you can fax. Now your fax becomes useful. Same thing with phones. Yeah. You'd say the same thing with phones.
So the value increases
with the number of nodes in the network.
Yeah.
So this increases proportionately until everyone has a fax machine. Now everyone uses a fax. And so that's what a network effect is. The more value the network has, the more people become attracted to it, and the more likely people will stay.
Yeah. There's an ecosystem. The switching costs increase, right?
The switching costs increases to leave the network. This is why, let's say, sellers use, I don't know, hypothetically, eBay instead of Etsy or something, right? Or vice versa, is because there's more buyers in a network. So, and the other thing is I knew that network effects existed. So knowing that network effects existed, I knew that it would be more valuable to create a network of units that is spread out from each other rather than create one giant building with lots of units inside.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So I was like, that will make it close to the user. That is valuable and kind of things like that. Like, and so I had different frameworks in my head at the time. Then I was thinking, okay, well, obviously electronic locks and doors are emerging. This is a unique moment in time where no one really, and even today, no one really appreciates that that is interesting or cares about it because most people use locks like in an everyday way.
Yeah.
Right? So you have all these kind of things that are kind of coming together
Yeah.
And so you're like, ah, it feels like a moment in which something like this could happen. The question I always ask myself now is, because it's beyond the point where we've raised, like if we had raised like no money, and you don't know the inside of my company, nobody really but us internally do, but it's not a scam. Like we've raised $80 million and there's a reason, right?
Yeah.
The thing that I always wonder is was I, I'm pointing to it, there's a water bottle cap right here. It's like, I picked up the idea like this. I picked it up. And now I'm holding it. And what I'm wondering is that idea was sitting there for like at least another year, a year before that. It's like, would someone else have picked up this idea if I had not picked up this idea right at that moment? Did I pick it up and so no one else could pick it up?
Yeah.
Or could someone else pick it up? Would someone, would have just stayed there for 5 years?
Yeah.
Had I not come up with it, right? Like these are the kinds of things that you kind of think about. Anyway, so what you're looking for is you're looking for different moments that make it, in French they would say le moment propice. What it means is the right time, the right timing where something unique can happen.
Yeah.
And if that's correct, and you could really sell yourself on this, so it's very important not to sell yourself on it, then you might have something and you have a shot. And basically, you've made your own luck, to go back to what we were saying earlier.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I think when I've had the best ideas in the past, there were a few small ideas that I'd worked on. And it was a similar thing where I was seeing, like one of people listening that know me, we might have talked about this. It was a concept of pop-up restaurants and supper clubs that already existed. Mm-hmm. And to go to those supper clubs in people's homes was just, it was a terrible process. There was no platform for it. And there really isn't still. Like there's one or two that have done okay, but never hit the scale that I thought it could do. And that was the same thing. I'd written the idea down in 2006 in Google Docs. And then I think in 2010, I saw this old doc and the world had changed. Like Facebook was a different beast. Airbnb, whenever I read it, was around and people were sharing their homes. And in 2006, that wasn't a thing. So I was like, oh, people can share their homes. Of course they could share a meal in someone's house. So that those kind of, I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but it's just applying
Those.
And
you're having concepts. Those ideas all the time.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's hard to tell like which ones are correct. This one I knew, this is interesting because at the time I'm fascinated by someone I know recently said this in my company. It might've been my head of marketing. We were sitting in an elevator and he said, I'm a very unstructured person. So in order for me to be good at what I do, I have to create enormous structure around me to make it work. So I'm the same. I have like zero willpower, but the reason that I'm able to make anything work is because I have systems around me. Mostly they're in my phone. So I have like apps that keep me structured.
What
thinking.
Apps do you use for that?
I use an app called OmniFocus, which is an insanely expensive app.
Okay.
It's for the web and mobile version. It costs them like $200.
But it's worth it for you.
It works for the people it works with, for. And so at the time, I had this one idea and I was like, huh. And in my head, I'm like, I'm going to forget about this. And instead, what I wrote in this other app that I was using at the time was work on secret project. All I did is like a daily habit app. And all that I did is I wrote work on secret project and I would, every day I would check it off when I did it. And I worked on a tiny, tiny thing like every day. And progressively, like this, it's literally what led to this, is the fact that I kept on this idea. And the more I kept on it because it was so interesting and unique and felt big. And I kept at it because I had a habit up on my phone that kept me from forgetting.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would have, you know.
That's interesting. You brought up the conversation about habits and developing habits. That's actually switching gears a little bit. I've heard you speak about this before. You've kind of done that throughout your life and you've taken on new things, new actions that you get used to doing. And everyone listening to this, whether that is to lose 10 pounds or to eat healthier or to be more present or whatever it is that they're working on, everyone's trying to develop those habits. How do you think about developing those habits and how can people take some value from the way you think about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm happy that we brought this up. Without systems, I would be nothing. And so I really mean that. What most people I think fail to see is that they need to build a system around themselves for future decision making. And so that future decision making has to involve whatever. Actually, I've got a whole bunch of them. I've got them on my phone. So if I pull out my, I have an app that I use. I have an app for everything, but.
What app's this one?
This one is called Streaks.
Streaks, okay, so yeah, I've
connects,
heard of
that one. You know that app?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it connects to your Apple Watch and it has six things that you can do and it tries to keep, so you try to keep streaks of them and it connects to your Apple Watch. So you see it literally on the front of your watch every day, right? So the six things that I have today and I've had for a long time are stretch, which means stretch out at the beginning of the day, meditate, which is to meditate 30 minutes a day. One of them is to take my medication because I have epilepsy. So remember to take my medication every day.
It's important.
Yes. Another one is practice Spanish because my girlfriend is Nicaraguan, well, from Canadian, but from Nicaragua. And it's important that my Spanish become better.
Yeah.
One of them is to play the piano. And another one is to read 40 pages, which is a version of a reading a book every 7 days. And so this is one example of a system that will tell me tomorrow what I'm going to do tomorrow, regardless of how I feel. Because if it comes down to what I feel, I will do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I will order Uber Eats.
Yeah.
And then I will make an enormous number of bad decisions. So I've just gotten very good at looking at when I need to do something, looking at the system versus what should I do now? And that structure is, I think a thing that I believe that lots of people need. I don't actually know if everyone is capable of it. I used to believe that everyone is capable of it. Now, I wonder if some people are just not that kind of person and they need something else that works for them. But this has always worked for me. It's like two or three apps that essentially control my life.
Yeah. So what about after the morning? So you've got like a morning routine. I think I've even...
But this is not my morning routine.
Oh, really?
This is my routine throughout
the day. Yeah. Will it keep reminding you though? You just remember it because you
I just remember it. Because it's on my watch.
Okay.
Right? So I do things to deliberately put it in front of myself.
Okay.
Right? And so if I have it in front of me, if I don't have it in front of me, I'm fucked. Yeah. If I do have it in front of me, then it will work.
Yeah.
So it's just little things like there's lots of different ways to build habits. One of the ways that they would do it, you hate flossing. Everyone hates flossing, but some people are very good at flossing. Some people are bad. They would say, I know you think flossing is annoying. Just floss one tooth. Right? Like something so inane and small.
Yeah. Once you've done one tooth,
then it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And the way that I got to meditating 30 minutes a day, which is actually quite hard.
Yeah.
Is to begin with 1 minute. And every day that I succeeded with 1 minute, I would just move to the next day, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's your whole life has to be kind of thought of this way.
So just walk me through your day then, because it sounds like you've got quite a structured day. It sounds like you've got an interesting routine.
Yeah.
So what time do you wake up? How's that go down?
I wake up at around 6:30.
Yeah.
I do a thing called morning pages, which I don't even need to have in the app. I just have been doing it for like almost 2 decades.
Is it an app or is
it? It's not an app. Morning pages is a thing that comes from Julia, I forget the name of the author, but a thing called The Creative Habit.
Yeah.
And essentially it's three long form written pages per day. And so I don't do it exactly that way, but that's the way it's supposed to be done. And so you can basically dump anything you want on these pages. It doesn't even matter. You can burn them afterwards, but it just allows you to expose yourself to your own thinking and to structure your day. So I do that. I write 1,000 words a day, which is something
just
that
handwritten.
Not handwritten. No, not
on your phone. Or?
Now I write them on my laptop.
Oh, on your laptop.
I have an app. I open it. It's like really
peaceful.
So like
it's the first thing you do when you wake up is
I make a cup of coffee. I make a Chemex cup of coffee because I'm a hipster. And then I write 1,000 words a day. And then I begin my day, which is the things that you just sort of saw.
Yeah.
I used to have a habit of going to the coffee shop. This is when I did not have a good coffee machine. But what I needed was a moment of solitude so that I could begin my day like focused. And now I get that from making coffee at home and sitting in a specific spot. And then I go to work. My day is basically filled with whatever I decided on in prior days. I'm religious about my calendar. So everything that I do has to work based on what the calendar says. And so from 9 to 5, like I'm at the mercy of the things that I decided last week or whatever.
Yeah.
Then 3 days a week, I go to the gym. I do heavy lifting. And then I go home and I have a pretty normal few hours afterwards. And
what time do you normally finish in the evening? after work?
It really, because I'm continuously thinking about Breeder all the time. So I might leave at 6 or 7, but I could be doing work till any future hour. Like it really doesn't matter. It just happens to be when I leave the office or whatever, right?
Yeah. Just to finish things off, super interesting, man. Like I really enjoyed what we've talked about. Just to tie it all together, it sounds like you've been growing like crazy. You started it when you might not necessarily have always wanted that. It doesn't sound like you were like, oh, I want to start a big company one day. It just kind of has happened. What's really motivating you right now?
Yeah, so that's a great question because when you run a company like this, you're motivated at different times by different things. So I used to be motivated by getting users and getting product market fit. And now that just happens, right? Because I have people that work on that together with me. We work on a team. I would say the most motivating thing, it is getting to know the use cases. So even today, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people will be using this service.
Yeah.
And when I talk to those people, I'm just endlessly compelled by the fact that I made this up and that they're using it, right?
Yeah.
So that's super motivating. The other thing that's motivating is when you work at a startup and it has a meaningful pile of cash and it's growing really quickly, you have access to talent that you would not have access to in the regular world. So at Google, there's a lot of people like this.
Yeah.
But when it's a small company, it's incredible. You have access to people and they want to work with you on this incredible thing. And so you have this amazing group of very talented people all together, all rowing in the same direction, hopefully. And that's amazing.
Yeah.
Like that's a very unique experience. Startups are very hard for lots of reasons, but the fact that I started this and that I get to work every day with incredibly talented individuals and teams is endlessly motivating to me right now.
Yeah, that's great. You mentioned a couple of times people that were successful. So if I was to say successful people, who sticks out to you and what makes them successful to you? Like what does it mean to you to be successful?
It just means to be satisfied with your life, whatever that is. It doesn't mean to be rich. It doesn't mean to be famous, certainly. It doesn't, it just means that you do something that you have designed a life around yourself as much as you can that gives you a form of happiness. And that doesn't have to, for me, that happens to involve this thing. But I don't think that needs to be the case. You know, I was hanging out with a Zen monk on Sunday, and he has people over to his rather large apartment, and they just sit there and meditate half the day, and he has people, he welcomes them in, and that's amazing for him, right? So I don't think that there should be a standard for this. The standard should be whatever you want it to be, but it should be higher than you think, probably.
So what about for you, though? So what is, because you said balance, and you said...
So I love the idea of making a dent on the universe and having my life having been for something right now. That's what I care about. Also, I'm very interested in, just from a day-to-day perspective, getting things in my life that matter to me, such as spending time with my girlfriend and my dog and being able to write every day. And basic things like that that are very fundamental and simple.
You enjoy them and you know that you've enjoyed it. All right.
Very easy.
All right, man. That's a great way to leave things off. I appreciate you coming on the show, man. We'll definitely be hopefully working together at some point as well in the long run. So thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks. I had a great time.
I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. And please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm, or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.